Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast with your host, Andrew Keel. This is the podcast where you can get the education you need to invest 100% passively in the highly profitable niche of mobile home parks.
Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Keel, and today I'm excited to welcome back Kevin Bupp, founder and CEO of Sunrise Capital Investors. This is Kevin's second time on the show. He first joined us back in episode 18 in 2021, so we're thrilled to have him back now that it's August of 2025. Kevin comes with over 16 years of experience in mobile home park investing. He has built a nationwide portfolio that includes mobile home parks and parking lot facilities. He's also the host of the top-ranked Real Estate Investing for Cash Flow podcast, and he's the best-selling author of The Cash Flow Investor. Get your copy at kevinbupp.com. Welcome back to the show, Kevin. How you been?
Andrew, my friend, appreciate you having me back. No, and I can't believe it's actually episode 18, you said, 2001. I feel like it's been such a long time. It has, right? The whole world has changed in those last 4 years.
So much has changed. It's so crazy. But yeah, I'm just thrilled to have your friendship. I know we've spoken, geez, probably once a quarter for that whole, you know, that whole 4 year period. So appreciate you.
Agreed, man. Yeah, no, appreciate you as well. And looks like you're doing great. Life is good for you up in North Carolina now. So congrats on the move and just the change of scenery. It's always a good thing.
It is. Yeah, we're loving it up here. So I did something a little different than all my other podcasts for this one. So I went into ChatGPT yesterday and I typed in, you know, what questions should I ask the famous mobile home park investor, Kevin Bupp? And the response it gave me, Kevin, just blew my socks off. It was like all these answers, all these like really good questions. And then at the very bottom, it said, you know, if you prompt me again, I'll create a list of curveball questions to ask. And so obviously I started there. You know, I just said, hold on, we're going to just scrap all these other ones and go straight to the curveball questions. So if you don't mind, you know, if you haven't, you know, seen Kevin's first interview, he talks a lot about his background and his story back in 2021. But in this episode, I'm going to try to catch Kevin off guard with some curveball questions about mobile home park investing. First question on the list was, hey, what's a deal you still think about at night? Not because you bought it, but because you passed on it.
Oh boy. Yeah. That's I know which one immediately comes to mind. And there's a number of them. Cause like, you know, I'm sure you probably feel the same way looking back. You know, we've been buying since 2011 and, you know, world was very different back then. You know, you could buy parks a lot cheaper. And so like, if we weren't, you know, buying things at like 10 caps, right, we would pass on them, even great properties. And looking back, I wish I'd have bought probably not everything that we passed on, but probably 90% would have worked out incredibly well. And even when I thought they were overpriced, you know, 10 years ago. So, but there is one, and it was actually the first park I ever got under contract. And it's interesting how it all played out is that this is when I got introduced to the niche. I was excited about it. You know, looking at a lot of deals, making offers. And this one actually came up on LoopNet. And it's 2011. It was here in Florida. It was up in Palatka, Florida, which is, I guess, like up near St. Augustine area over on the other coast. And it was listed by a broker. I forget how many sites. It's been so long now. I think it was like 90 sites. It was listed at $599. I went and visited the property and it's like your typical story, mom and pop owner, you know, for like 45 years, like literally had all the keys hanging, you know, in his office. His desk was like literally a massive pile of papers. I think there was maybe about 15 vacant homes in the community. It was city water, city sewer. It was like right in the middle of town. So it was a great location. But, you know, the thing, I got it under contract. It was owner financing, I think like 20% down.
You know, the business plan was— Did you say $599, like $599,000?
That's it? Yeah.
For 90 lots.
This is 2011, right? I mean, like this wasn't a popular niche at that point, right? And maybe it was 80 lots. It was somewhere between 80 and 90 lots. It was under 100.
Still.
And it had about 50, I think it had maybe 7 or 8 vacant lots. It had like 15 vacant homes that are in really rough shape. I mean, like literally have leaky roofs for many years. Like the insulation's fallen down, you know, basically demos. Maybe a few that were salvageable, but these were old homes already. And so kind of, you know, trying to pump 15, 20 grand back into them, you'd have probably lost. And so, but you know, I got under contract, great owner financing terms. It was like 100 grand down or, you know, somewhere along those lines. I think it was 20%, so 100 grand down, some attractive terms. And I got cold feet. I got cold feet for a number of reasons. The main one was the lot rents in this park were, I think, 180 bucks a month. And, you know, theoretically understood the business model. You know, the market rents in this area were 350 at the time. Now they're probably like 700, but they're 350 at the time. And theoretically understood that basically all I really had to do is get the rents up to like 275. And this thing was like a knock it out of the park home run. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't even have had to rehab or demo the, or, you know, do anything with those vacant homes. This thing would have been just a, you know,
crush,
you know, 20% cash on cash return type stuff. Right. Basically what Frank and Dave were teaching at the time. Right. Yeah. I was just trying to follow their model, but I got cold feet of what was going to happen, or because what might happen when I raised the rent, basically $100, even though they were paying half of what the market was, I was still going to bring it up to below market. I got cold feet because I thought there would be a mass exodus. And back then it was very, even though Frank and Dave had a community, there wasn't a lot of resources. There weren't other park owners for me to really talk to and get comfortable and just, you know, get me comfortable in the fact that other than Frank, right? Like that no one's going to leave, or if you lose somebody, they probably should have gone anyway, right? Like you're going to basically retain the majority. And so I passed on it. I literally, within like 2 weeks, I was like, this is not going to be a good fit for me for XYZ reasons, whatever excuse I gave. And I backed out of the deal. And then like 2 weeks later, I woke up in a cold sweat and had the realization that I'm an idiot. And like that and I called the broker back up and it was under contract and that person closed on it. Ugh. And funny enough, just in a roundabout way, like 4 years later, I told the same story on my podcast and a guy emailed me and he basically, it was the guy that bought it. He's the guy that bought it. And I interviewed him on the show and we talked about the business model and what he did, and he had just sold it. So he had just turned it around and then sold it. And if I recall, I don't remember all the number, but I think he sold it for 2.7 or 2.8 million, like, you know, 4 or 5 years later.
Wow.
And again, he bought it for $600. He basically had the same terms I had. Jeez. You know, he put probably a few hundred grand into it. I probably put 300 grand. So he was into it for $1 million call. And he sold for 2.8. And then it traded again. I kind of followed it thereafter. It traded again for, I think, like 4.5 million, maybe just like four years ago, give or take. And so anyway, that one, I let that one go. I realized it 2 weeks later, but I was too slow. You know, hey. I shot myself in the foot but we got another one tied up and life turned out well. But I regret that.
Wow. That's awesome. It kind of sounds like Frank's Glenhaven that he talked about, the one in Dallas, except he actually did buy it, but no,
he did buy it.
The first one, you know, you weren't ready yet. It's okay. But you know, it took a little bit, but the next question is really good here, Kevin. Which lesson in your career cost you the most money to learn?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'd say, you know, I think one of the biggest, and there's probably a lot of them, but I'd say one of the bigger ones is underestimating the cost and complexity around a large infill model. And there's a lot to it. You know, it's not just, hey, man, all you got to do is call up Clayton or call up, you know, whoever and order some homes. Truck's going to drag them in there. You call up the local setup crew, pick from one of the three that are out there, and they're going to show up on time and they're going to treat you well and treat you fair and they're going to do the job right. And life is good, right? You're going to sell that home shortly thereafter and get at least what you have into it. And now you got this new person living there paying full market lot rent. It's like that's how it's pitched. Yeah, right. And, I think that's the lesson is that it's not easy. It's not easy at all. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say we ever lost money by buying something and actually paying for the future value based on us actually being successful with the infill. But we actually, for many, many years, up until probably 3 years ago, we really steered clear of major infill projects. And so for that reason, we probably left a lot of money on the table, you know, deals that we passed on that we should have bought that we could have probably actually knocked out of the park. But we were pretty late to the game with putting the emphasis and the focus on building out the team and the infrastructure necessary to run a successful large-scale infill model, which I know you guys have been great at, right? Like you actually were probably one that that I would lean back on as far as like, this is how you do it right. And I know that you kind of took it into your own hands because a lot of the frustrations as you were trying to do infills, you know, trying to find reliable, you know, setting crews and transporters, and you went and bought trucks, right? Yeah. Like you took the problem and found the solution for it. But so that big lesson learned there, again, we never really lost money because we bought something or overpaid for it and then just failed miserably at the infill. But we left a lot of money on the table because we passed on deals that would have been a great opportunity.
Well, thank you for the kind words. Yeah, infill is still tough. We still make mistakes. You know, we still have hurdles. Like we bought a park in Georgia, had 16 homes we infilled, and we put decks on all of them. And the city came back and said, hey, we're not going to issue the certificate of occupancies because all of your decks don't meet the code of how they require it. And so you got to redo all the decks and everything. It's like the little things that you know, you'd think that at this point, you know, you'd have ironed out, but every municipality is a little bit different. So it's difficult. It's difficult, but it can be very fruitful, very, very beneficial when you get that occupancy up. Here's the next section. It's called Unpopular Opinions. What's a belief you hold about mobile home parks that most other successful investors would disagree with?
I don't know that they would disagree with, but I know that there's a number of groups that steer clear of it, and it's public or private utilities. I know there's a few groups specifically that literally will not buy anything that have private utilities. That's just their business model, and it's not right. It's not wrong. But I've just early on, I got really comfortable with understanding private utilities, wastewater treatment plants, septic systems, wells. And I think getting comfortable with that earlier on, we bought some great opportunities that others maybe passed on, or we just didn't have as much competition because the private utilities were in place. I think that's kind of changed quite a bit today. I think there's such a limited supply of opportunities out there that groups that may have historically shied away from private utilities have now reconsidered that, in order for them to continue growing or expand their footprint. Like they need to really look hard at private utility makeups and find a way to get comfortable with them if they want to continue growing their business. So we did that early on. I think the second park or third park we bought, I mean, it was on at least on private sewer. And then today we own, I don't know, handfuls of parks that are on either wells or wastewater treatment plants or septics. We've got plenty of others that are on, you know, public utilities. In a perfect world, sure. You know, Andrew, everything would be on public utilities. Everything would be direct build. We wouldn't even have to go do submeters or do bill backs or any of that. But again, I think you got to get comfortable with the wide variety and wide spectrum of utility makeups. The only thing that we don't own and we've never owned, and I'm not opposed to owning it, we just haven't had the opportunity to buy something that's got a lagoon setup. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's good to know. Yeah, we started only buying public utility stuff. And then over the last few years, very similar to what you're saying, we just had to buy some stuff and pivot. And so we have some septic and wells now. No lagoons or treatment plants. But again, it's just getting comfortable with them and understanding the systems. And it was just part of our criteria. We just didn't even look at those deals because we didn't have that experience. But yeah, that's awesome. What's one rule of thumb in mobile home park investing that you think is dead wrong?
You know, I think the back of the napkin math has changed significantly over the years. I know probably back when you were going through some trainings, trying to run, if it has public utilities, you know, use a 30% expense ratio. If it's got private utilities run on a 40% expense ratio. And I think that still floats around out there today. You know, I see brokers that just do quick and dirty write-ups on maybe an off-market deal and they send it out. And I'm like, to this day, maybe I'm wrong, but maybe we're running things too rich on our side. But I don't think I've ever seen anything in our portfolio that's operated less than the 35% expense ratio. If you're doing everything right and you're putting money back in, you're setting aside necessary operational reserves and repairing things when they break. Again, I've never seen anything that's operated on these, you know, some of these crazy low operating expense ratios that get pitched. I've even seen some come out that are like in the 20s. I'm like, okay, I don't know how you get there. Factor in tax reassessments, factor in recapture loss on water and sewer bill backs. There's a litany of things that go into the equation. You know, the cost of payroll. I think the cost of having on-site managers has risen significantly over the years. I mean, I remember back when you and I were going through training, it's like, hey, like all you really need is a greeter, right? Like you give them free lot rent and they're fine. And that might exist in some parks, but like, I don't know, we pay our folks a living wage, right? And they have opportunities for benefits, you know, healthcare and things like that. And so you're not getting that for $7 an hour or minimum wage. Like you got to pay a living wage to these folks. And so once you start adding all that up, the expense ratios tend to veer more in the 40% to 45% range, and sometimes maybe even higher if it's like a weird anomaly where there's like high real estate taxes or something like that. But anyway, I think that would be my answer to that one.
Yeah, no, I think you're exactly right. Like in Illinois, we have the same property in North Carolina would have like $6,000 a year property taxes. In Illinois, it's like $30,000 a year.
Yeah.
It's crazy. So you got to, every property is unique. You can't just put a blanket expense ratio on it. So yeah, I agree. That's a really good rule of thumb that a lot of people teach, you know, is the expense ratio piece.
If you do that, like you're going to either get deals accepted that once you actually dive deep into underwriting, you're going to realize that like you're not able to pay what the offer that just got accepted. And so, you know, like just to avoid that situation, try not to use the quick and dirty, unless you already own something nearby and you're very comfortable with the operational expenses of, you know, what your other park is, then that's a different story. But if it's like a new market, it's new to you, just dive deeper into the analysis and don't make offers on back of the napkin.
Yeah. No, that's a good tip there. All right. Gut calls versus spreadsheets. Tell me about the last time your gut told you one thing, but your spreadsheet told you the opposite. Which one won?
Yeah, I think the gut always wins. I mean, we just had a deal. It was last year, that phenomenal market in Maryland. We own in Maryland, and this was a really expensive submarket. I'm not going to give the exact details, but median home price, you know, $380,000, you know, two better rents, $2,000. I mean, just all the demographics that we look for, where there's a huge need for affordable housing. And it was a fragmented park. And so it's like 300 spaces, and we were buying like 170 of them. It started out as a subdivision 40 years ago. And I don't know the entire story, but basically got the original developer started selling lots, and now it became a fragment. And so half the community owned their own individual deeded lots, like literally the people that own the mobile homes. And then the other 150 or 158 that we were buying, you know, they're kind of spread throughout the park, some side by side, but others kind of spread throughout the park. And on paper, this thing looked like a home run, you know, just no way to lose. And as we drove it, we realized there's a couple factors there. Number one, the quality of the individually owned properties, most of them, 70% were a train wreck. I mean, like trash everywhere, yards overgrown, just a mess. And we would never be able to control those individuals.
Those lots, yeah.
And this small town, it was a small little, like a little village. They actually didn't have their own code enforcement. They literally had, there's like two police officers in this town. They didn't have, you know, the budget to have like a dedicated, it wasn't even a big enough town to have code enforcement. So there was no way to ever even get the support of the local township to help clean this mess up. I mean, there was like a homeless encampment back in the woods behind some of these homes. I mean, it was a mess. And so the spreadsheet told us that we were going to make a killing, but my gut told me, and just, you know, visually seeing it, that would have been an uphill battle. I don't think we would have ever made it to the top. You know what I mean? We'd never been able to plant the flag at the top and say, we won. This thing was a great deal and was worth the time, energy, and effort. So we moved on and passed on it.
No, I think that's a good decision. We had one of those similar deals, and it was like fragmented like that. And I think you can't control the odd ones, you know, if they have dogs or they have fences, and it's just an odd one. And then the financing too was what ultimately made us pull the plug, is because the agency lenders didn't like those type of fragmented parks. But that's good. There's one on a war story. So which problem or war story in your portfolio made you lose the most sleep, and how did it end?
Yeah, war story. I don't know if I lost sleep on this one. And this was this is the beginning stages of it, but I'll share because I think it's a pretty cool story and it's got a cool outcome. It was the first park that we ever bought, Georgia. It was in the Atlanta MSA. It was in a little town called Lovejoy, and it was an incorporated little town. They had like their own mayor and their own chief of police, but population was like, I don't know, 10,000, 12,000 people. So, but it was inside of the greater Atlanta MSA. Hmm. And bought this property. It was an REO. When I went to see it, like literally there was only one, it had 34 lots, 29 homes inside this park. Of those 29 homes, only one was occupied. All the rest had been managed by the receivership for 2 years. And for whatever reason, they vacated the units and literally got rid of all the decks and all the stairs. I don't know the strategy behind it, but there was one person left in here living in there. They're paying like $450 a month. It was just a rental. These had all been park-owned rentals. And so, we were buying it at, I was excited about the basis we were buying it at. And so I was super pumped about it. And I was excited to go, you know, before we got into contract, while we were in due diligence, the mayor's office, they had just built this brand new office. It was where the chief of police and their staff resided, as well as the mayor. And it was literally catty corner to this park. And so they would have to drive past this community every day to get into their office. And so as part of our strategy, normally we like to go meet with the local council, town council, and just, you know, especially if it's a big turnaround, you know, if we feel like it's got a bad reputation, we want to share kind of the strategy, how we're going to improve upon it. We're here to support, you know, the local community, and just, you know, want to make sure you guys have a direct line to us. If you have any questions along the way, you'll feel free to reach out. So anyway, we scheduled a time, my partner and I scheduled a time to go meet with the mayor. thought it was just going to be the mayor. He brought like literally the entire staff, and there was like nine of them in there. Chief Police was in there. And they were in there when we got into his office, and we sit down and we look around his office. He had like a stuffed fox on the wall. He had a rifle hanging, you know, just a bunch of odd ornaments around the office. And then this guy rolls in, Mayor Bobby Cartwright is his name. And he's like 6'3", bald, big, and a handlebar mustache, you know. Very threatening figure, right? And so it was very fitting. I saw rifles and stuffed foxes on the wall, right? And he sat down and he introduced himself, shook our hand. And he said, what do you got? You know, like, just go ahead and give us your sales pitch. And so we went into it. I was excited, just excited about all the great things we were going to do, the money we were going to inject back into this blighted community across the street that they had to look at every day. And he let us ramble on for like 10 or 15 minutes. And then we stopped. And I was like, you know, we'd love to answer any questions you have. And he looked at us and he said, Mr. Bupp, he's like, I just want to let you know that it's been my God-given duty for the last 5 years to try to shut that park down. It's been a blighted part of our community for many, many years. It's been vacant now for 3 years. It's a cause of a lot of crime. It's a drain on our resources, yada, yada, yada. He just went his whole diatribe of like how bad this place was, and that literally it was his God-given duty to make sure that this thing never opened back up again, was never repopulated, and that he was going to shut it down for good. And so he suggested that we take our investment money and go find another community in town to go invest it in.
Oh, geez.
And yeah, not the receptive audience I thought it was going to be. And so, and that kind of ended the conversation. I literally did not know. I did not have a rebuttal. I was not prepared for that. And so we graciously, you know, shook his hand, thanked him for his time. We walked out, and this was our first part. And I was pretty broke back then. I had lost everything in 08. And so I had to make this deal work. Like, this was like this was the first property that was going to rebuild what we've ultimately been able to build today. And so I looked at my partner, we were both putting like, I think like 75K of our personal money into this deal, which was it was a $220,000 park, right? And it was like, what do we do? I'm like, I still think that if we just do what we say we're going to do, like, how in the world, why in the world would they ever shut this down? If we actually follow through and do what we say we're going to do, we make this nice and we attract good people here. And we did that. And we just gave the code enforcement officer our direct phone number, said, hey, I get this thing's been a drain. We've had, you know, squatters in here. We've had people dumping stuff. Just call us if you see anything. Chief of Police, Sammy, if you call, just call us and we'll work with you. We'll be here to support you guys in this initiative to clean this up. And we did that. And a year later, I never heard from the mayor. I thought we were going to get a lot of pushback. We just went on with our plan, did our thing, cleaned it up. A year later, I get a call from the mayor. I didn't have the number saved on my phone. It was like, Mr. Bupp, this is Mayor Bobby Cartwright, Lovejoy, calling to basically apologize and let you know that I'm sorry for the way I treated you a year ago. I apologize for, you know, the conversation and altercation that we had in my office. And I thought that mobile home parks were the problem. I've come to realize after this past year of watching what you guys have done that is not the problem. In fact, we've got some great residents living there. In fact, one of my staff members actually lives in your community. And so complete 180, you know, and I actually got him to write a recommendation letter on letterhead, basically saying as much. And we've used that on a number of occasions where we've had pushback from other communities that we were going in, trying to buy parks that were run down and needed turned around. And so anyway, I know that was a long-winded story, my friend, but I thought it was very fitting.
No, that's awesome. Yeah, I love how you remember his name. Mr. Yeah. Bobby Cartwright.
That's right. I still have the letter, man. I don't think I've used it recently, but we used it for many years. And we didn't lose, but like that was a deal. And maybe I lost sleep back then. Like, that had to work. That literally was the last. That was literally my only money I had. That I kind of carried through. Yeah, I salvaged from the wreck of 2008. And it had to work. I couldn't, like, it literally, it couldn't not work. And so we still took the chance, took the risk, and push forward, and it was a huge win. So
kudos for you, because I think a lot of people would have walked away. Like, we have parks where, like, when the city kind of, you know, says that it's going to be really hard to infill and things like that, and now I want to inspect every home or I'm not going to approve it when you move it in, like, sometimes we shy away from that instead of, like, just going at it. So kudos to you, man. That's awesome. I want to make sure we get to these other questions, because there's some really good ones in here. Legacy and big picture. When you retire, what would you want the headline about your career to be?
Oh, that's a great one. I think that one of our big, hairy, audacious goals internally is to make a dent in the affordable housing crisis, and basically do that by serving 15,000 families with home ownership. And so we're on our way there. And I know that, and we say make a dent, right? Because, like, to think that we can solve the affordable housing crisis that exists in the country is full-hearted, but I know that we can make a dent in it. And I think that by, you know, helping 15,000 families, you know, buy their home, whether it's their first home, their second home, but buy an affordable home in a clean, safe, and quiet community where they can raise their family in peace and send them to good schools. Like, I think that's us helping to make a dent in the affordable housing crisis. So I think definitely some variation of that in the headline, I think, would be a pretty cool thing.
Yeah, dude, 15,000 is a ton. So yeah, that's an awesome goal. If you could magically change one thing about the mobile home park industry overnight, what would it be?
I think the negative stigma that still exists, I think it's gotten better over time. But as you and I both know, a lot of municipalities, like, they kind of all lump us in the bad bucket, especially like you and I. I mean, we buy you know, communities and they're in great markets, but a lot of times they just haven't had any capital put back into them. They haven't had love, right? They hadn't had that capital injection or anyone that really has cared for it for a number of years, sometimes even decades. And so, you know, for that reason, I think we almost always just get lumped in that bad bucket, you know, just kind of, you know, we don't want you here anymore. You're the wrong element. You attract the wrong people to our community and to our neighborhood. And so I think, again, I think it's changed. I think, you know, having professional operators like yourself and our group and many others out there that have come and actually put the money and the love and the care into these communities has gone a long way. But still, there is a negative stigma. I'm sure that you see it all the time as well. And I wish that would go away, because I always use the comparison of, for those that aren't familiar with mobile home parks and that don't realize that not all these communities are on the wrong side of the tracks, is that, like, we're no different than apartment complexes and single family home neighborhoods, right? Like, you can go to any city in this country where you live, where I live now, and there are apartment complexes that are in the wrong part of town where you don't want to go to during daylight hours, right? There's also apartment complexes that are in the good, hardworking parts of town, right? Just blue collar folks that want to send their kids still to good schools. They want to pay their bills on time. They want a clean, safe, and quiet place to live. And then you've got class A stuff, right? You know, white collar stuff that are in urban core areas, the high rises, you know, they got multiple swimming pools, amenities, same with single family home neighborhoods, right? You got all three elements there. Mobile home parks, kind of the same thing, right? You got all three elements. Yeah. For some reason, we all get lumped in the bad one, unfortunately. So I hope that goes away at some point in time.
Yeah. No, it'd be nice. And I think with the new capital coming in, you know, I think it's, people are more interested in giving the benefit of the doubt. But, you know, there's still some of those that are just kind of run down. And yeah, it's just nature of the beast. But like you said, any asset class, you look at apartments, there's still those lower tier, you know, just the bad landlords that aren't taking care of them. So that's right. Good. Next section says risk and resilience. Which deal in your career looked like a surefire win until it wasn't?
Yeah, there's one that comes to mind that we sold a couple of years ago. And honestly, I've looked back on it and I've tried to reevaluate it many different ways and using, you know, data, using gut feel. And I think I would have bought it again. And for the life of me, everything went wrong in the community. You know, we had a major poaching problem of our homes leaving the community over a period of like 3 years. So we lost, like, I think it was 150 space community, give or take. I think we had like 25 homes, maybe even a little bit more than that over a period of like 3 years that left the park. That was
Oh my goodness.
And even trying to stop, it was very difficult.
Was it like one individual or was it just like a bunch of different scenarios?
It was for the most part. But as long story short, they had a piece of land on the outskirts of town and it was individually deeded lots. And someone had inherited it and they went in and started selling off these lots for like 20 grand a piece. And they were zoned for mobile homes. And so they literally put an emphasis. I don't know why I'd say that we had the biggest negative impact of folks leaving compared to other parks nearby. But so that kicked our ass. And then there was a litany of other things, infrastructure. We had major challenges there with infrastructure. The city was very difficult to deal with on like the water. We had a main water meter at the front of the park that it literally broke on a couple different occasions, the primary meter. And it literally took like a day or two to get it shut off. Specialty equipment was required. And our bill each time was like $60,000. Oh, and, you know, like all these things that just stacked up that continued happening over a couple of years. Yeah. And I still, looking back, it was inside the city limits. It was literally 2 miles down the road from Oklahoma State University. I mean, there's like 60,000 students there. Yeah. The demographics are strong. It's an hour and a half north of Oklahoma City. City water, city sewer, nice layout. I mean, everything pointed in the direction of like, there's no way that we can't be successful here. But it kicked our ass nonstop over and over and over. And it was one that, it was a big breath of fresh air when we finally sold that property and just like, let's move on. Cut the losses and call it a day and move on. So
yeah, isn't it crazy? Sometimes like the person you sold it to may have a completely different experience. But we sold a couple of properties and we were like the same way, like things just kind of went wrong. And then we sold it and they've had a good experience with it. Haven't had like the turnover we had and stuff, but geez, sounds like that was just a bad luck situation right there.
Yeah. And I'd say that, and this is not to put the blame anywhere, because I think it was just a tough community in general, not from a resident standpoint, because the residents were good for the most part. Like it wasn't high crime or anything like that. I mean, it was just your typical run the mill, you know, down the fairway, you know, blue collar, hardworking folks. It had a nice pool, had a nice clubhouse, it had a lot of the elements. And we even sent, you know, we have a team that's worked for us, community managers. Like they've literally worked with me for like 11 or 12 years now. And they've kind of become our traveling rovers. And they've been operating the one community for like 4 years now that we put them in. But historically they'd always been the ones, whenever we had something that needed fixed, like we got to get like, let's put the best managers that we have. The wife is the manager. The husband is like kind of the do-it-all. He can do everything. He's good at running crews. And we sent them there and they lived there for 2 years. And they're like, I don't know what to tell you. We don't have the solution here. You know, this is an uphill battle and we can't get it going in the right direction. So that was a tough one. I still looking back, I'm like, I don't know what the hell the problem was there in that town. And just, we had a hard time selling homes. We couldn't even give brand new homes away. It was so weird.
Yeah, that's a tough one. If the mobile home park asset class suddenly disappeared, how would you make your next $10 million?
That's a good question. Well, hopefully it will never disappear. I think that it'll be here for many, many decades to stay. But, you know, for those that don't know, we do invest in one other asset class, not as long as we've been investing in mobile home parks, but it's parking. So parking garages, parking lots. And so that makes up a decent portion of our portfolio. And so we love that asset class for some of the same reasons why we love mobile home parks. It's very fragmented, hasn't been consolidated yet. There's still a good bit of inefficiencies in that sector with, you know, the advancement of technology and dynamic pricing models and things like that. And so we're really bullish on that sector. And so I would, you know, if mobile home parks just vanished overnight, I would just probably, you know, put 100% of our resources and efforts into growing that side of the portfolio.
Awesome. Awesome. All right. I got a little lightning round here with five questions I want to ask you. And I just want you to just say the first thing that comes to mind. Is that cool?
Okay. Yeah.
All right. So the first question is, if you could own every mobile home park in one state, which one would it be?
Florida.
Mm. One state you'll never buy a mobile home park in. And why?
New York. Regulatory restrictions and just tough to do business in.
Mm. Biggest mobile home park myth you want to bust in one sentence?
That rentals are great.
When you hear mobile home park, what's the first image that pops into your head?
Yeah, just, I don't know. The single wides, a community full of single wides. Okay. Nice, clean, nice sign, you know, trees, playground, happy families.
That's good. That's good. If lot rent caps become law, what's your move?
I think just to underwrite to it. That's all. You know, if I like the state, we like the market and we can buy it knowing that, you know, we can still, you know, hit whatever metrics we need to hit with the caps in place, then we'll buy it. If we can't, we move on.
Move on. All right. That's the end of the lightning round. That was pretty harmless, right?
Yeah. That was a good question, though.
Really at the
questions.
End, it was like, you know, you can ask if you want me to, I can make these spicy. It was like, do you want spicy lightning round questions or do you just want lightning round questions?
Were these spicy or not?
These were not spicy. Yeah. Okay. The other ones were too much. But yeah, that's all I had for today, dude. I hope you enjoyed,
awesome,
you know,
man.
Coming on. This was great. Yeah. I really appreciate your time, you know, coming on the show, and it's always good just kind of, you know, learning from you and hearing about your experiences. So
yeah, appreciate same brother. You. No, always good to catch up with you and appreciate you having me on. And I know you're just getting back to the swing after being or having a great summer and just spending time with the family. So hopefully this was a good warm up to get the show up and rolling again.
Definitely. Definitely. Would you mind just sharing a little bit about, you know, how our listeners could get a hold of you and then maybe about your growth and income fund for, you know, before you drop off, if you don't mind?
Yeah. So if you want to learn about our current offerings called SCI Growth and Income Fund 4, you can learn about it by going to our website. It's investwithsunrise.com. You know, we've got, you know, webinars and case studies, and, you know, you can kind of see what deals are currently in our current fund. That fund will be wrapping up here at the end of this year, probably towards the end of Q3 here. And we'll be rolling out a new fund Q4 of this year, which will be SCI Growth and Income Fund 5. And so, but our funds are, I mean, they're pretty, again, down the fairway, with the only exception that the last couple of funds we've done have been a mixture of parking and mobile home parks. And so typically there's one, two, sometimes three parking assets inside a respective fund. And it's normally overweighted with MHC. So it's kind of an MHC fund with a little bit of parking. And the growth a lot of times comes from the mobile home parks, because there's a lot of value add stuff we do. Whereas a lot of the parking are cash flowing day one, they're, you know, core plus type assets that are throwing off, you know, distributions from day one. And they're really the income side of the equation. So it's a really nice, you know, complementary mix there. As far as finding me, you know, you can track me down on, you know, again, through investwithsunrise.com, that website, but I'm pretty active on social, more specifically LinkedIn. So if you want to, you know, just reach out to me through LinkedIn, you normally can get a hold of me there. So and my last name is unique. And if I always joke and say that, Andrew, my last name is pretty unique in that if you just go to Instagram or Facebook or LinkedIn and type in Kevin Buff, I'm pretty sure I'm the only one that comes up. So
you're unique in that aspect, yeah. You know, you and Bobby Cartwright, those two names are pretty easy to remember.
Everyone's going to go look him up. You should look him up. Look at the image on Google when you type in that Mayor Bobby Cartwright, Georgia, and tell me if I was accurate in my description.
The handlebar mustache. I'm going to look for it. Well, that's it for today, folks. Thank you all so much for tuning in. If you got value out of this episode, please consider leaving a review. It helps us get more listeners and helps more listeners find the show. Yeah, that's it. Thanks.
Would you like to see mobile home park value add projects in progress? If so, follow us on Instagram at @passivemhpinvesting for photos and awesome videos from our recent mobile home park acquisitions. Once again, that's @passivemhpinvesting on Instagram. See you there.